ACEC is excited to announce that registration is now open for its fall conference taking place in Marco Island, Florida, this October. That's right, after a year of Zoom and virtual meetings, we're excited to be bringing our fall conference back as an in-person event. And we can't tell you how excited we are to look forward to seeing you there in person for all of the content, networking, and education that the fall conference is known for. Log on to www.acec.org for more information. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Given the complexity in today's design market, engineering firms need to have access to a broad breadth of expertise. Smaller and mid-sized firms usually must contract with those experts, but larger firms have the option of bringing them in-house. Cardno, an international infrastructure and environmental firm ranked number 58 in the latest ENR rankings, chose to do that in their Portland, Oregon office by hiring Sean Fackler as the principal archaeologist. Sean and Cardno Business Unit Manager Karen Beatty have joined the program to talk about the role of an archaeologist in an engineering firm. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you. Happy to be here.
So can you tell us what the role of an archaeologist is in a larger engineering firm?
Yeah, so it's multiple layered in a sense. There's various laws, federal, state, and municipal laws that protect cultural resources. So the cultural resources side of the work for an archaeologist kind of gets rolled into that and falls underneath the bigger, grander environmental laws. And so you've got the federal National Historic Preservation Act of 1966 laws that protect the cultural resources that ends up doing the Section 106 process that a lot of people are familiar with. For anything with a federal nexus. But then the state laws have kind of, they've kind of mirrored those federal laws and most states, all states have their own laws protecting the cultural resources that mirror, a lot of times mirror the federal process. And then in addition to that, you also have some of the state environmental policy act, like Washington has and California has their own version. That also adds another layer of a regulatory layer that usually that there's a nexus for cultural resources and the need for an archaeologist.
So which type of products do you work on mostly? Who are the clients that the projects require an archaeologist?
The clients can be anywhere. A lot of times federal agencies, the department, everywhere from the Department of Defense to Department of the Interior with all the different land agencies. A lot of times the work will be beyond their scope of what they can do. And so they can hire an environmental consulting firm to do some of their work on behalf, for them. A lot of times our clients could be private clients, developers, that sort of thing. Where there could be a nexus either with federal money or federal lands, or in that matter, state money or state lands. Or just some kind of nexus where there's something that needs to deal with permitting in the overall environmental permitting side of things. Sometimes, it can be something that triggers it as far as like needing a wetland permit through the Corps, and therefore that could trigger a Section 106 process. So there's lots of different steps, lots of different triggers.
So you mentioned cultural resource sites. What exactly is that, and how do you go about recording and documenting a cultural resource site?
So cultural resources is can be archaeological resources, which you typically think of like, in the ground, below the ground, things that are in ruin. They also could be historic resources, much like a historic building, a historic bridge. So we have buildings and structures. They could also be a landscape and a place, of traditional cultural practice. A traditional cultural place. So it's threefold, and the technical side of it for a cultural resource for the federal aspect of it is anything that could be over 50 years or older. Some states have a different requirement, like for instance, Oregon, the state requirement is anything 75 years or older, it can be considered a cultural resource. And so that's our baseline. Now, just because something is older doesn't necessarily mean it's significant. So, evaluating that resource, whether it's an artifact or a site or a property, that goes through a whole nother process that could potentially impact a project.
Yeah, I guess our having a relatively young country, it does our timeline is a little shorter than say Europe or something where they might have several hundred years to create something that's old enough to be saved.
Well, in a sense, but again, we're looking at, being historic in the sense of it could be prehistoric as well. So we do have prehistoric sites that go back, thousands of years, if not 10,000 years or older. So
wow.
We do have some deep depth as far as that.
So when you're working as an archaeologist, is your work ever seen as maybe being a roadblock to design and construction?
Definitely can be. A lot of times, 9 times out of 10, it's usually seen as that. Sometimes it's an afterthought, or sometimes it's not thought of in the planning process. It can. It's all about planning. It's all about consultation. Plan often, consult early is kind of like the motto. The reason being is, a lot of our work, we don't know what's in there, until you actually break ground. So what happens is, you might have a project where, there might not be a requirement to do an archaeological investigation, but it could be an area where there are archaeological sites. And if you don't do the any studies beforehand, you have the potential of encountering those. And if you can encounter some of those archaeological resources, well, then, you've got the different regulatory statutes in different cities, states, and of course the federal laws that protect those resources, and so which can shut down a project until such studies are done. So the idea is to do any kind of cultural resources study early and way in advance of the actual project initiation phase. And as far as planning, the earlier you plan, these studies are involved during the planning process, the better. And typically what we see is, 10-20% designs, 30% designs. That's usually when a lot of times when we come in, when you kind of have like a general idea of your project footprint, the types of disturbances that might occur, what it's going to impact, that's usually the time that we come in. If not beforehand, just in case that there are things that are found and sites or places that are significant, you can plan accordingly. Either preserve in place and work around them, or come up with a good mitigation strategy to move forward if designs cannot be changed.
And really, we spend a lot of time educating the engineers and designers. If you, as Sean said, plan early, we can actually make sure that the project is going to go ahead of schedule, and also make sure that we're saving as much construction money as possible by seeing if we can design around or try to do something that minimizes impact. So it does, although it's seen as a impact, it's actually a way to help save money as you're moving forward with the project.
Is this something that happens on every project? Does the archaeologist get called in, or is it only in specific places where there's archaeological history?
That could be pretty much every bit, as far as where archaeology might be. You really don't know until you do the background research and hire an archaeologist. But people have been everywhere throughout this, throughout the country, throughout the world. And so there's pretty rare when you actually find a place where there's nothing. Well, now, whether or not there's evidence of that remains to be, seen. But it goes back to those regulations and laws. And so, yes, I'd say most of the time, 9 times out of 10, if there is any kind of public funds or lands involve some form of cultural resources, you know, studies need to be done, conducted at some level. Where you just see that where it doesn't happen are private developments purely on private land. But again, you know, depending on the state that you work in, that could also be irrelevant. Like let's say in Hawaii, even, you know, private developer on private land, still there's a requirement, there's a state requirement to do archaeological investigations. So again, it varies state by state. And a lot of times, like going back to what you said, a lot of times the developers, they've learned, you know, early on to do, you know, due diligence as and incorporate some of the archaeological studies early, even if they don't have to do them as part of the due diligence. So that way there's no unknowns that might come up, especially in areas where, you know, are generally known to have, you know, a high frequency of archaeological sites, say like the American Southwest, Hawaii, you know, other places up here in the Northwest as well. So
when you speak of archaeological investigation, does that mean that you're down there in the dirt digging, or are you in a library somewhere looking up records?
Could be both. It's usually both. And so there's different phases of a cultural resources investigation. Again, I use that term cultural resources because it could be the built environment too. You know, it could be, you know, let's say we're developing, a property is being developed that's got, that's next to a creek that's got an old farm on it, right? It's got an old barn, old farmhouse, and it's by a creek. Well, you could have prehistoric sites there. You could have the historic archaeological sites there being trashed up. And then of course you have the building itself, which is part of the built environment. And so usually the first thing is doing some kind of survey level, you know, either reconnaissance or like an intensive survey, basically getting archaeologists and historic preservationists out there walking the property, looking for archaeological sites, looking at buildings, looking at structures, and determining whether or not they're of age or not. And the second part of that is taking that and then evaluating those sites if sites are found. And so it's doing the field work aspect of it. That's usually, it's usually like a lighter effort. Sometimes there could be shovel tests or subsurface testing in form of backhoe trenches, that sort of thing, to take a look at what's going on underneath the surface. So we call that a survey phase. And then if something is found, if the project can't avoid and preserve in place, then what we do is we usually test those archaeological sites. And when we go in the testing phase, that's typically what you might see and think of an archaeologist as far as like putting in square 1 meter by 1 meter, you know, units and going down there and hands and knees, the trowel and looking at things. And so basically we're testing, and there's various methods on how to test an archaeological site. That's part of the evaluation phase of whether or not that site's significant. And then that either, again, moves forward either by saying preserve in place or moving forward. And if the site is significant, then usually data recovery is needed. And that's, again, more of what you see, those square 1 by 1 meter, you know, units and going down very slow, 5 to 10 centimeters at a time, going down very slow, screening all the material. And then of course, dealing, analyzing and curating that material, that the artifacts that are recovered from those sites.
Sounds like a lot of work.
It can be. And of course, incrementally, you know, where it gets us on the consulting side is there's a lot of work. And so of course that translates into dollars, right? And so, you know, the survey phase, regardless of the amount of field work, is, you know, quite a bit, you know, less expensive than full data recovery, obviously, because there's more labor involved, more analysis, more things, more robust technical reports, that sort of thing. So it becomes very pricey. That's why, again, it goes back to, you know, consult early and often, you know, on the front end of it. So that way you can kind of know, because then you can kind of steer the project and ideally the design plans in a different direction. And a lot of times that does happen, right? We go out in the field and say, you know, somebody wants to put, you know, redesign an intersection and make a roundabout, and they might have to buy some properties, adjoining properties and extend some right-of-ways. Well, we do our research and we say, okay, you know, early on, and we say, hey, listen, there's a huge site right here. And, you know, it's best if you can avoid it, preserve it in place and just avoid it. And early on, they could say, okay, we could do that. We can kind of, you know, shift the design, you know, 100 feet, you know, to the east, and we can avoid that. Everything is great. Versus wait, you know, down the line where, you know, properties have been bought, the design's really focused, you know, and there's no other, route to go other than straight through this site. Well, then the only way you can move forward is by doing all these extra studies, and again, becomes much, much more costly on the back end and impacting these resources than if you could have did it on the front end, even though there might have been some costs up front for that design, that project redesign. You know, it's going to cost a little bit more than at that phase, but it's going to be significantly cheaper than on the back end, you know, where you're dealing with properties and things like that. So I hope that explains it a little bit.
What role does technology play in your efforts? Has technology advanced the science of archaeology over the last few years?
Yeah, quite a bit, and especially in the past like 10, 20 years. I mean, you know, the big thing in the 90s was, you know, with Clinton releasing GPS, you know, to the public, you know, that was a big step up for us, you know, using the Trimbles and really kind of getting subsurface, you know, accuracy on mapping, that sort of thing. So that was a big plus. And what we're seeing now, more recently, of course, GPS, ground penetrating radar, which a lot of people are familiar with, but that works in, you know, better or worse in different environments. It doesn't tend to work that well up here in the Pacific Northwest. But the thing that we're seeing recently is with the development with LIDAR, is basically more incorporation with LIDAR techniques, whether it's on the ground or aerial, to varying degrees, and incorporating LIDAR to find archaeological sites on the ground. And that's either using public LIDAR data or private data. That's grown quite a bit. And then that in conjunction with drone technologies and, you know, basically using drones to also help survey areas at a closer range than you might get with like aerial photography, you know, existing aerial imaging, Google Earth, that sort of thing, is by basically just using some of that drone stuff with a drone operator there on site. And so we're seeing that's being incorporated quite a bit more. Then in conjunction with that, it's just field recordation. So, you know, for a number of years, it was, you know, basically just a yellow pad of paper and out in the field, just write down your notes or a notebook, that sort of thing. We've gotten away from that in the past 30 years, as far as like getting like at least more standardized forms. But now what we're seeing is more incorporation with digital, you know, handheld devices, tablets and phones, and incorporating that with Bluetooth GPS receivers, basically to streamlining the whole process, whether it's with the GPS and field notes and field data, and just incorporating it on a smaller device. And it's that's helped quite a bit.
In your work, what's been the most unexpected find that you encountered?
That's a tough question. You know, that's like the you know, any undocumented resource could be, you know, obviously unexpected, and depending on what phase you are in the project, you know, it's usually, you know, it can be pretty stressful. The biggest thing though is human burials, you know, that the sensitivity that surrounds, you know, human burials and, you know, human remains is so high. So that's, you know, it's definitely, it's not maybe the fun, you know, the golden idol, the Indiana Jones kind of thing that people always want to hear about. But, you know, it is something that's, you know, it's very meaningful and, you know, very, 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 very sensitive. And so, you know, coming across human remains is definitely challenging as far as a coordination and consultation with, you know, Native American groups, that sort of thing. But yeah, that's, those tend to be kind of the most interesting and most, you know, challenging finds.
So you focus primarily on the northwestern part of the country, is that so? Or?
Recently, yes, I've worked throughout most of the country. Kind of started out in the southwest, And then, yeah, strategically moved up to the Northwest about 6 years ago.
And can you sort of speak to the differentiation between regions as far as archaeologically speaking?
Yeah, definitely. You know, so in the Southwest, you know, the vegetation covers much less. And so, you know, the preservation is a little bit better. So you have you can find a lot of artifacts, a lot of those cultural resources right there on the surface versus out here with bioturbation and vegetation. A lot of those materials get buried and stay buried. And then, of course, the soil is so much more acidic that, you know, usually organic materials and kind of organic artifacts, you know, those tend to kind of erode and, you know, dissolve away, and you just don't see so much of that in the subsurface. Out here, what we have to do a lot of times, just because the vegetation cover, is we have to do shovel testing during the survey phase, where like in the American Southwest, you could just have a survey crew basically do pedestrian transects on the surface, you know, and look for artifacts and find things and go from there. Out here, what we need to do is some level of subsurface testing, and that's usually done in the form of shovel testing. So circular probes, you know, dug by hand with a shovel and screened through to look for artifacts. And then what we typically find out here are lithic materials. So debitage for making projectile points, like spear points and arrowheads, that sort of thing.
So Karen, is Sean the only archaeologist at Cardinal, or do you have others around the country? Or
We have a very large cultural practice, not only here, but throughout the country. We specialize in a number of different areas. Sean alluded to sensitivity around human remains is quite a big deal. We have groups that specialize in cemetery and burial recovery, especially in the Southeast and also in the Midwest. Here we're doing a lot more work with utilities like PG&E, Seattle Public Utilities, Southern Cal Edison, where we're working in conjunction with teams that are going out and doing utility replacements. So we're constantly one step ahead of them, looking to make sure that they're not potentially impacting areas. Also spending a lot of time with our restoration groups as we're looking to restore stream and river beds to minimize impacts to flooding. And the archaeologists are very sensitive to that. We also support remediation. So if we're going to in and doing a large remediation effort with potentially digging away contaminated materials, we're spending a lot of time supporting those groups. So it is one of our strongest practices, and having Sean here just adds to the depth of experience that we're able to offer clients.
Well, great. I think that's a good place to end. I'd like to thank both of you for coming on the program. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome. And you've been listening to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by ACEC and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Thanks for listening.